Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, history, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And today, we're going to talk about Draculas. I said Draculas, plural, and I mean by that the different iterations of Dracula since he first appeared in Bram Stoker's novel, 1897. I originally planned on doing a vampires episode, and I realized that I was going to spend most of that episode actually just talking about Dracula and the different versions of Dracula that we've seen in films and pop culture. And then I realized, oh, well, what I need to do is a Dracula's episode, so here we go. So I guess the place to start would be around Bram Stoker's original novel, 1897, Dracula. He did a short story called Dracula's Guest. And Dracula actually doesn't appear in the short story, Dracula's Guest. It's about some hapless, overly adventurous British tourist out east in Europe and around Transylvania, right? And he goes through the woods at night on Walpurgis Night, you know, the night of witches and black magic, the one night a year where the dead rise from the grave and all wise people lock themselves indoors, except for this British guy who wants to go on a walk through the woods. He encounters in a tomb this woman who is... well, she's actually a slain vampire. She's pinned down with an iron stake through her heart. But on this night, she gets to rise up for a moment before lightning puts her back down. And then these other monsters are closing in on him. And one wolf in particular holds him down and licks at his throat until he is rescued. And the people who rescue him suspect that maybe this wolf has kept him warm to keep him from freezing to death over the night and kept him protected from the other monsters, even though it seemed like the wolf wanted to eat him. It was weird. And then he's like, well, why did you come for me to rescue me anyway? The Englishman says, and they're like, well, we got this letter from Count Dracula saying, you know, spare no moment. If you suspect that this guy is missing, go out and find him because I want him kept alive. And that's essentially the end of the story. Like, so there's some suspicion that Dracula was the wolf who is trying to keep this guy alive, perhaps for a later meal. I don't know. It's weird. But Dracula really doesn't show up until this novel. Now, where did Bram Stoker get this vampire Dracula idea? The primary influence is John Polidori's short story, long story called The Vampire. That comes from that magical night in which he and Lord Byron and Percy Sherry and Mary Godwin all got together and told ghost stories because it was too rainy and spooky to go out on a proper vacation outside. So they stayed inside, did a ghost story competition. She came up, Mary came up with Frankenstein. John came up with a vampire story. His vampire wasn't much at all like what Bram Stoker ended up doing. But Bram Stoker drew from some of the folklore that he had been researching, especially Eastern European folklore, and a little bit of history, particularly on Vlad the Impaler, also known as Vlad Dracul, son of Vlad Tepes. And these were Eastern European noblemen who were of the Order of the Dragon. And that's what Dracula means, like son of the dragon or of the dragon. These were vicious rulers. Vlad the Impaler was called the Impaler because he tended to take his enemies, still living if he could get them like that, spear them or skewer them onto large pikes, and then post them around the outer rim of his territory. so that he got so many of these bodies, some people still living, but not for very long. He got so many of these bodies around the perimeter of his lands that this was called the Forest of the Impaled. And there's one story of an army marching up to invade him, invade his lands, and they get to the Forest of the Impaled. And upon a single look at this vast, reaching horror of countless men skewered on tall spikes, they went, nope, never mind, we're out. And then they just turned around and left. So it works as a deterrent, I guess. So he mixed a little bit of this and that, those three being probably his primary influences, and created this book. It's a really cool book, Dracula is. It's a kind of multimedia. I think in a previous episode, talking about it ever so briefly, I said if it were released today, it would be like hypertext linked. It would have YouTube videos with it. It would have MP3, or it would have, song files playing in the background. Because at the time, he incorporated all the newest technology, at least in a fictional way. You begin by reading somebody's travel journal. That'd be Jonathan Harker's travel journal. You move on to Mina's, like her diaries and journals. And then you get transcripts of, say, newspaper articles and newspaper clippings. One character records his journals and his findings as he does his research on his patients in an insane asylum. He records them on those wax cylinders that we used on phonographs before, the flat disc records started coming out. And so his chapters are transcriptions of those wax cylinders, and it jumps around from character to character throughout the book until eventually, toward the end of the book, Mina's perspective takes over. So it's a really cool mixed media type of storytelling. And in the book, Dracula is this ancient nobleman who, well, the story starts that he wants to move out from where he is in Transylvania to the middle of the biggest, hoppinest city on planet Earth. If it happened in 2018, he'd be moving from, say, Afghanistan to New York City. And 1897, it was from Transylvania to the middle of London. He wants to buy up real estate there, and he's not explicit about why, but he bought up strategic locations around London. And later, Van Helsing starts to suspect that, oh, he's trying to set up his vampire empire right in the hub of the modern world so he can start infecting people and spread out and take over the world. And that's one feature of Dracula that I've never really seen run with in any of the films. They took what little bit of romance there is in the book. It's not really a love story, despite many of the film versions or a lot of pop culture about Dracula. There's not much love story in it. I mean, there's some subtext that, there's some sort of lust and love and romance going on, but not much directly. Well, there's also subtext of Dracula wanting to take over the freaking world. That's pretty cool. So he has a real estate agent come out to him. The last one, he kind of turned and not into a full vampire, but slowly started driving him insane and created a minion out of him. And he starts doing the same thing with this new real estate agent, Jonathan Harker. And then he gets himself over to London and starts turning, one lady into a vampire, a lady associated with Jonathan Harker and his crew named Lucy. And she is creepy. She sneaks through London at night away from her crypt where she was buried when she died, because Dracula slowly drained her of blood over night after night. So she creeps out, and you get these newspaper clippings of the woman in white, or the white woman, moving like a ghost out of the cemetery and snatching up little children and drinking their blood and leaving them dead and lifeless. And she's the first vampire that Van Helsing gets in this story. And so he and Van Helsing gathers the crew with them, and then they go and they wait outside her tomb. And they end up making anti-vampire paste. They would take holy wafers and mash them up with holy water and make this paste and kind of rub that on the seams of the door, or the openings of the door to her tomb, so that she can't easily slide back into her tomb through those thin cracks. They eventually stake her through the heart and decapitate her, fill her mouth full of holy wafers, all of this to keep her from rising back up. The stakes don't have to be wooden. If I remember correctly, they're iron or unspecified, but a lot of the old folklore wants us to eliminate vampires and witches with botanical materials like white oak, for instance. Which white oak happens to be good for healing infections and wounds, by the way. So they end up chasing down Dracula, using what they know of his supernatural weaknesses to start cutting off his options and turning the tables on him to get him on the run. And then the last part of the book ends up being a chase scene as Dracula's trying to get back to his stronghold out east in Europe, while they're trying to get there before he does. And he's eventually fully ended by Jonathan Harker and his Kukri blade. It's a pretty cool kind of curved Indian knife. That's the original novel in a nutshell. And man, it was a big hit at the time and continued to be. Not many people had seen anything like a vampire in a story. And in this story, they got this sense of the old, they got not only the gothic, but they got the new media. They've got a chase story. They've got hints at romance. They've got this this horror that can sneak into your house. And then it's mixed up with all these other fears of old, decrepit ways corrupting new progress. It gave people kind of a reason to think, oh, maybe there's a scientific basis of understanding the old world fears, so that maybe we should still kind of fear the old things. Just now we'll say there's a scientific reason why it exists to keep those fears alive, especially with all these the new findings in the late 1800s of diseases of the blood and how easily that can spread. So a huge hit, and rightfully so. And the first time it was really filmed was in 1922. There was a German expressionist film called Nosferatu. That film was originally just supposed to be Dracula, but Bram Stoker's widow was still alive at the time, and so she sued them in the production of this thing because they never ran it past her or got her permission. They weren't paying anything to the estate for filming Dracula. And so rather than just shut down the project, they just changed the name. And so they, rather than Count Dracula, they changed his name to Count Orlov, changed the names of some of the characters, but not that much, and just went with it. And she ended up being rather unsuccessful in her attempts to stop him and sue him after that. And Nosferatu, man, if you haven't seen this thing, you have to watch it. It is beautiful and terrifying. And the guy who plays the vampire in Nosferatu, his name is Max Schreck, or maybe it is. Those of you who know a little bit of German are like, Max Schreck, that's basically like your name translating to, you know, maximum terror or a bunch of horrifyingness or something like that. That's what Max Schreck means. And he is so convincing as this vampire. He's not like sexy and cool and aristocratic. He's like a gaunt, dead, half-human, half-rat looking thing. And some of that's not makeup. It's amazing. So for a long time before we had easy access to obscure records as we do now on the internet, there was this this rumor, I guess what Wikipedia calls it now, secret histories or something like that. But it was just this like folktale rumor that maybe what the original Nosferatu did with the director F.W. Murnau, maybe what he did was find an actual vampire out there and force him to be in the movie. Maybe Max Schreck was an actual vampire, because for the longest time, the only film, you know, that at least in America that we could find of Max Schreck was this thing. So out of nowhere comes this one amazing strange actor, and then disappears. So it was a, you know, people were saying maybe it was a real vampire. And you watch this thing with that in mind, and you start thinking, well, kinda, maybe it's possible. They end up making a film about the making of that film and playing with that story. Not too many, I don't know, 10 years back? Was it 15 years back or something like that? In which Willem Dafoe plays the Nosferatu vampire, and then they run with this concept that he was an actual vampire being forced by this lunatic director into this film. And he ends up being kind of, you know, pitiful, and you feel sorry for him, even though he's a vampire. It's pretty cool. But if you're going to spend time with it, make sure you spend time with 1922 Nosferatu. Time out for a question from the audience. This question is, well, how did Dracula become a vampire originally? Well, that's a good question. And the book never really says, and so, and Bram Stoker never really said in any other writing that we know of him. In fact, it's all just speculation. I think the closest you can get to an answer would be looking at the kinds of things that Dracula brags about or talks about of his own history to Jonathan Harker when he first welcomes him into his house toward the beginning of the book. He talks about his proud history as, you know, as knights defending their territorial lands against the Turks and slaughtering a lot of people. And he particularly identifies one of his ancestors that he's so proud of as Attila the Hun. He says Attila the Hun is one of his ancestors. He's in the direct line. Attila the Hun, by the way, is a really cool character. He even shows up in Saga of the Volsungs as a pivotal character toward the end of that saga. That's the same saga in which Sigurd, the dragon slayer, goes and faces Fafnir the dragon. We talked about in an early Monsters and Literature episode. Attila the Hun shows up in that thing, believe it or not. And so Dracula, in saying this, I may be going too far in my assumptions, but I'm allowed to in my imagination. So when I read that, I imagined that that's Dracula's way of saying, I was Attila the Hun, by the way. And so why not? I mean, we hear that the Huns, when they were on these long campaigns riding their horses across vast steeps and through miles and miles of snow, they would make little slits in the sides of their horse's neck and drink a little bit of the blood to nourish them and keep them warm. So they would drink from the blood of the horses they were riding at their neck while they were riding them as their like instant coffee on the road. That was what the Huns did. And I imagine that Attila, being their leader, not only approved of it, but maybe kind of taught him this. You mix those couple of weird little pieces of folklore together, why not? Maybe he was originally Attila the Hun, and also in the book we find out from Van Helsing that Dracula at one time was an alchemist and a man of great learning and a practitioner of the black arts. And so maybe he was a type of witch, wizard, alchemist, and he figured out a way to make himself undead. Or maybe he just in his research encountered some other vampire and became one. I like the idea that at one point he was Attila and then ended up becoming a vampire. So, good question. Tangent done. I need to get to the famous version of Dracula, Bela Lugosi's 1931 Dracula. But before I do, we should back up and say, well, what are these Features of Dracula. How did Van Helsing and his crew beat Dracula or get the best of him? Or what do you do if you find yourself up against a vampire like Dracula? Well, you could try the whole sunlight thing, sunlight killing him, but that wasn't in the book at all. That was an invention of that 1922 film Nosferatu. In which sunlight was what ended him. That was their idea. In the book, sunlight doesn't hurt him at all. It does weaken his powers. He isn't as powerful in sunlight. Dracula isn't as powerful in sunlight as he is at night. He can't shapeshift during the day as he can at night. He's not as strong. But other than that, it has no real effect on him whatsoever. He seems to be repelled by garlic. That's in the book. Crucifixes or the sign of the cross seems to repulse him and hold him back, although it's not a sure bet. He seems to avoid mirrors and has no reflection, and so mirrors or the absence of a reflection seems to bother him quite a bit. Holy items like holy wafers, holy water, any sort of consecrated item, those tend to be rather onerous to him. But there were some weirder features in the book that never really show up in movies because they're not very filmable. One of them is that Dracula can't cross running water unless it's at noon or at midnight, right? Like at high tides. He can't cross running water. And so there are moments in, especially in the chase section of the book, toward the end of the book, in which all Dracula needs to do is get off the boat that he's been transported on and off and onto land so he can keep on with his travels and not lose ground to his pursuers. But he can't get off of the boat and onto shore because he has to wait for midnight to come around or noon to come around. And so he has to just wait there for hours because he has no ability to cross running water. You're familiar with the feature that he can't really enter your house unless you let him in or you invite him in. But he also has powers of hypnosis, that if you give him your attention, then he can suggest to you to invite him in, and then he's on his way in. And another major feature of Dracula is that one that's not really captured as much in the films, but it is in Francis Ford Coppola's 1992 version a little bit, is that he can only really rest and regenerate if he does his sleep of death in his native soil. And when he's in Transylvania, that's no problem. He's got all of his native soil all around him. But a big logistical problem for Dracula was if he's moving over to London and he needs his native soil, he's got to ship a bunch of crates of soil over. And that ends up being actually a strategic feature of the book, in which Van Helsing and his crew find his storehouses of soil and they bust it open and consecrate it, essentially ruining the effects that it would give Dracula, essentially ruining his ability to rejuvenate in this soil. And so he's got to race back to his soil to gain his strength back. And so he spends a lot of time and money bringing dirt over and then trying to protect the dirt. And defeating that dirt was a big part of the way that the good guys won against Dracula. At the beginning of the book, there's a moment where this mysterious carriage driver is taking Jonathan Harker up the winding path of the mountain at night up to Dracula's castle. And it's quite clear to any close reader that this carriage driver is indeed Dracula in disguise. On their way up, they see on the sides of the path these rings of blue flame rising up out of the ground. And at each one of these, the carriage driver stops the horses, jumps down, runs over to the blue flame, and piles rocks over the blue flame. And later we come to understand that on this night of all nights, at locations where ancient treasure was buried on these hereditary lands, blue flame rises up. And so essentially Dracula is trying to like multitask tonight. He wants to get his new victim up to his house, but he also wants to mark any old treasures that are hidden on the land so that later on a night when the blue flame's not there, he can go back and dig them up and have more treasure. I thought that was cute. Dracula can also, let's see, at night he can transform into a bat. He can also turn into a wolf, and he can turn into a kind of green mist or green fog, which ends up being quite useful to him. Okay, so how about Bela Lugosi's Dracula, 1931? This is the performance that gets iconic. If you have the image in your head of a guy in like a fancy suit for a formal occasion, a white shirt and black suit, black cape. He's got the like widow's peak slicked back hair and a high collar with like a medallion with a blood red ribbon around the throat. And so that's Bela Lugosi's version of Dracula. Bela Lugosi was a stage actor originally from the same place that Count Dracula is supposed to be from. Another reason Todd Browning cast him in that role, in addition to the fact that he was fantastic in the role, both on stage and on film. And Todd Browning was the director of Dracula. He's a fellow Kentucky boy, and he filmed, he's famous for Dracula, but also a movie he made the year after that called Freaks. And if you haven't seen that, 1932, I think it was, Freaks. Oh man, you got to check that out. That is awesome. It's about this clan of circus freaks and this drama that ensues within this clan, but he casts actual circus freaks as the circus freaks, and they're really impressive actors given the fact that they are not professional actors, and it's just fantastic. You know, I've talked to some people who find it quite disturbing, but I think it's kind of cute and delightful, actually. I don't know, but I like weird stuff and weird people, so who knows. Okay, so Bela Lugosi's Dracula, he plays it classic and cool and smooth. The Van Helsing in that 1931 Dracula is really great and very convincing in his like strict German sense of superiority. He's really cool. The guy who plays Renfield is a big surprise. If you watch it for the first time, he will catch your eye, man. He plays this really cool animalistic lunatic. And this became Bela Lugosi's most famous role, not only now, but during his lifetime. And he didn't really have a whole lot of success after that. The story kind of goes that Boris Karloff ended up kind of taking over the monster movie roles and pushing old outdated Bela to the side. And at best, Bela Lugosi could get like sidekick roles, like the famous Igor, like, yes, Master Igor. Well, Bela Lugosi played Igor. And he was pretty good at that role too. He's kind of good in everything he was in. And he did a lot of like self parodies just to make some cash. Ended up famously having a drug problem. Became good friends with Ed Wood. Tim Burton made a great film called Ed Wood about the friendship of Ed Wood and Bela Lugosi. And one of Tim Burton's great films. Tim Burton, made a lot of films, but a handful of them are great, and Ed Wood is one of them. And poor Bela had a rough life, and he ended up being, by his request, buried in his Dracula outfit. That's cool. I like Bela. So later on, other versions of Dracula. Christopher Lee started becoming famous for playing Dracula. I think he started these Dracula films in the 1950s, and then they just went on and on through the 60s, into the 70s, I think, with these Hammer films. And his version of Dracula was much more, not nearly as like slick and cool and calm and sexy. He played this aristocratic air quite well. I think that fits Christopher Lee. He might be a little bit like that in real life, but then then he turns like this vicious kind of like cannibalistic serial killer kind of Dracula. That was the first Dracula that made me realize, oh, it's more than just the supernatural thing. He's kind of beast-like. And that takes us back to perhaps even Dracula's Guest, in which that very first short story from Bram Stoker about Dracula, he might not be a vampire at all. He might just be a werewolf. And he's at least a partial werewolf in Bram's in the actual novel, since he turns from dead man to wolf. But you see that kind of ferocity in Christopher Lee quite a bit. In 1979, Werner Herzog and, you know, his always forever lead actor, Klaus Kinski, they came together and redid Nosferatu. That thing is a weird kind of film to see. They have some beautiful shots that they take a lot of time with, and I think it pays off quite a bit. Klaus Kinski's version of Nosferatu ends up being really sad and pitiful, and I think that becomes a different tradition of vampires that in the pure vampire episode we'll get more into, such as Guillermo del Toro's Kronos and those kinds of things. But I think that the vampire, something that actually is kind of sad and pitiful, is one direction to run with, and that's definitely Klaus Kinski's version. But he looks cool and freaky in that film for sure. Another notable Dracula for sure is Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula, 1992. It might as well have just been called Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. I don't really know why he threw Bram Stoker's on there, because it's very much a Coppola film and Coppola's interpretation of it. But it's good, man. It's cool. And Gary Oldman plays Dracula there. And so you get Gary Oldman in his full-on method acting. He probably drank real human blood to prepare for this role, knowing him. And he starts off by being the creepy, old, weird aristocrat Dracula with his crazy, like, bun, hair hopper hair. And they give, and he's got these big, long silk robes and long fingers and this weird kind of death-like pallor with this great makeup. And they give him a lot of these little features that Dracula had in the book that didn't tend to come up in film up to this point. For instance, one way you can tell a vampire or a werewolf is that they have hairy palms. And there's a moment in Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula in which, you know, Dracula opens his hands and you see that hair on his palms. Little details like that, I think, help sell the monster. So in Gary Oldman's Dracula, we get not only the old version, but then when he rejuvenates himself into the soil, he takes on this young form. And so you also get sexy Dracula, in which he gets his, like, you know, fancy hip new suit, walking around London with a mustache and a cane. And he's got these little sunglasses, which they had in the late 1800s. As a kid watching this film, I was both, like, fascinated by it and angered by it. I was a Bela Lugosi Dracula kind of kid, and I had no idea what they were doing with, like, old grandma hair hopper Dracula and, like, new, like, hippie hipster John Lennon Dracula. Like, what the hell is this? And it took me a little while to realize, and then I went back and read the book or reread it. I don't remember which came first in my experience. And then started to appreciate, man, Gary Oldman did a very cool job with that. They definitely emphasized the love story that's suggested, but not really extant in the book. But they emphasized that for sure, because it's a Hollywood film, and Francis Ford Coppola knows how to make those well. At this point, maybe we should take a moment to dig a little bit deeper into it and try to figure out, well, okay, we know kind of why it became a cultural phenomenon, the fears that Bram Stoker mixed into his cool kind of like action adventure horror story are catchy. The film versions were really well done and a little bit spooky and a whole lot of cool, so that makes sense. But there's probably something more if it just has latched on to the throat of our culture and won't let go. What is it? Well, I think one of the great storytelling features of this version of the vampire folklore is the Dracula root of this vampire folklore is that this kind of predator who comes after your life essence, that has been rendered in a bunch of ways, everything from energy to spirit and possession or your soul in danger. In The Exorcist, for instance, what's in danger is her soul. You get a lot of visual and vivid images of that attack on her soul and its side effects. But what is your soul? Well, that's a cloudy kind of image. So how does somebody like take away or feed off of your life force? Well, one really particular way to envision your life force is your blood running through your veins. And when you see your blood pouring out, you have a very stark image of your life force running away from you. If you have less blood, then you're closer to dead. If you have more, if you are hot-blooded, then you're full of life, right? And so this version of the vampire story took an abstraction that is a deep fear, but still an abstraction, and it found a wonderful particular image of that thing that everyone can relate to and that everyone has an immediate visceral reaction to, some more than others. I have known people who seem otherwise kind of tough, manly guys, and one glimpse of their own blood and they just hit the floor immediately, passed out, which is weird to me until I found out that there's a certain percentage of the population that are just genetically coded to have that reaction of blood as a kind of survival mechanism. Like it's a really vivid image of life and something sneaking in your window and sucking you dry of your blood. I mean, that's about as particular and as vivid as you can get. There's also this sense that makes Dracula appealing of something coming into your house somehow. Like you, it's not the monster like the dragon that will attack the city or that lives in the cave and it's your fault that you're getting eaten by him because you went out and found him. This thing comes into your house like a spider might get into your house, or a wasp might get into your house. If you've ever had wasps or spiders or any sort of other little predator coming after you in your own house and it's ever caused you real problems, you might feel a sense of kind of violation, like how dare you get into my house, plus how vulnerable am I actually? These things are coming in to attack me. How much more so if it is this undead creature that wants to suck you of your life force? That's a deep and fascinating feature. Wow, I'm out of time again already. I can't believe that. I feel like I only got really going. Well, at least when we get to our future episode at some point about other vampires, then we've got all the details about Dracula cleared out of the way. I hope you found some cool stuff in this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have some questions or requests or comments for me, drop me a line on my website, joshwoodsauthor.com. You can, by the way, check out my version of some vampires. Vampires show up in a couple of different ways in my novel, The Black Palace, available now on Amazon.com at really reasonable prices, by the way. Check it out, read it, leave me a review, no matter what you think on that. I hope you enjoyed this time with the Monster Professor. Talk to you next time.